You're listening to highlights from the Creative Processes interview with philosopher Keith Frankish. Frankish is a professor of philosophy at the University of Sheffield, the University of Crete, and a visiting research fellow with the Open University. This podcast is supported by the Jan Michalski Foundation.
There is magic everywhere. There's wonder everywhere. There's wondrous complexity that is so difficult to conceptualize, to grasp, to articulate, that it might as well be magic. But we can gradually start to unpick how the tricks are done, how nature learned to do these wonderful tricks. And that's the wonder of science, learning what's happening behind the scene and how these marvelous effects are produced. And probably best known for my work on consciousness, my view about this is often caricatured, I think, as a kind of heartless materialist one, because I'm resistant to all forms of dualism about the mind. I think that's a very unhelpful way of thinking. And some people think that I do that because I have a sort of crass materialist attitude to the world, that there's only things you can measure and weigh and bump into, and everything else is just nonsense and fancy. And what I like about the sort of view I have, it represents us as fully part of the world, fully part of the same world. We're not sealed off into little private mental bubbles, Cartesian theaters, where all the real action is happening in here, not out there. Now, I think we're much more engaged with the world. It's not all happening in some private mental world. It's happening in our engagement with the world, the shared world. And that seems to me a vision that I find much more uplifting, comforting, rewarding. And another one of my heroes here is Dan's great friend, Nicholas Humphrey, who has a wonderfully rich range of experience. He's been described here as a scientific humanist. What he does is he knows his science, he knows the cognitive neuroscience, the psychology and so on, but he also is steeped in literature and art and music, painting, and he brings all this together in his work on consciousness. His wonderful book, which he published in 2011, Soul Dust, because the idea that the soul is actually made of dust, what a fantastic idea. So there was one other quotation I was going to read you. It's a quotation from the neuropsychologist Paul Broks. It's one I love. And it's a very vivid illustration of one side of the illusion and the reality, one expression of the reality that it presents in a very, an almost brutal way. It goes like this. The illusion is irresistible. Behind every face, there is a self. We see the signal of consciousness in a gleaming eye and imagine some ethereal space beneath the vault of the skull, lit by shifting patterns of feeling and thought, charged with intention and essence. But what do we find in that space behind the face? When we look, the brute fact is there is nothing but material substance, flesh and blood and bone and brain. I know, I've seen. You look down into an open head, watching the brain pulsate, watching the surgeon tug and probe, and you understand with absolute conviction that there is nothing more to it. There's no one there. It's a time of liberation. And that's from Paul Brooks, Into the Silent Land. And I think the task, or I see my task, is to reconcile that rather austere vision. The same world in which that austere vision is true is a world in which there is love and dreams and poetry and meaning and significance and value and consciousness. And it's the same world. There doesn't need to be another world. It can be the same world. And that's the liberating point. I don't like this idea that the mental world is completely sealed off from the public world, that you can never really know whether a fish, say, is conscious, because that's entirely subjective. There's no possible access we could have to the fish's mental world. I don't think that's right. I think the mental world is more like an interaction with the public world. It's the world as it was striking the creature like a hammer striking a bell, and the creature resounding, responding to that. And it's that vibration that is the mind, I think. So that opens up the possibility of getting to know people better. It's not always going to be a mystery to us what fish feel. We just need to pay a great deal of attention to fish. The view I have is that we misrepresent ourselves as having this irreducibly subjective aspect to our experience. Now, that's the core claim. How do we represent ourselves, and why do we represent ourselves as having that? That's, I see, completely open to different approaches within an illusionist framework. So one view might say that there are dedicated introspective mechanisms with their own representational repertoire that have deployed concepts of something like qualia and that produce these judgments about our own Cartesian world. Now, if that were true, then this would be pretty universal among humans. And I think the one that Dan tended to prefer is that we've kind of talked ourselves into this in the Western philosophical tradition. And that this is more like a philosophical error, that the judgments we make are not derived from dedicated introspective systems that deploy something like phenomenal concepts, that it's a product of a certain way of thinking about the relation between science and the mind that emerged, I suppose, in the early modern period, I guess, with Galileo and Descartes. And Now, if that's right, then we should expect that other cultures would not have this intuition, perhaps to the same degree, or they might formulate it in different ways. So I was interested in the cultural relativity of this, I call the illusion, but specifically about that particular phrase, what it's like to be. It does click. Yes, something's like to be. That's a way of getting at consciousness. And a lot of people say, that will do. That's a good definition of the core of the essence of consciousness. Then we talk about what it's like to be-ness and what it's like to be properties, and we start reifying these things. This is one reason I use the term illusion. I love illusions. I think illusions are where we live. I think we live in a world of imagination. I love theater and poetry, the stuff that is, in a sense, illusory. They're wonderful things. They are distinctively human things that we've created to make sense of stuff that is really too complex to make sense of in any other way. But I think if we don't understand that that is their nature and that that's their function, then they can seriously mislead us. Because if we take the illusion for reality, then first of all, we're missing the function and we're missing what this is really doing for us. And we're misunderstanding our relation to the world. We're never going to prosper by having a distorted picture of reality. So calling these things illusory isn't to say we should stop seeing them that way. It's just a note of caution that there are certain areas, particularly, I think, in science and in philosophy and in ethics, where I think it can be harmful. And so all I'm not asking you to give up the illusion. I'm saying just understand that it is an illusion. Generative AIs, and particularly large language models, they seem to be engaging in conversation with us. We ask them questions and they reply. It seems like they're talking to us. I don't think they are. They're just making moves in this game of language. They have learned through training on vast quantities of human-produced text, which was making significant communicative moves. So what we've produced is a kind of simulacrum conversation, and a very convincing one. So convincing that it looks as if we tempted to attribute to the LLM all the desires and the intentions that we would attribute to a human saying those things. And it'd be false. Now, that seems to me worrying. Communication, what we're doing now, is the lifeblood of human society. And we're devaluing it by creating things that can just simulate it at a entirely superficial level, that can play poetry as a game. There's no way we can get these things to self-regulate. They have no sense of organisms. They don't care about anything. We can't try to get them to care because they've no interests. Their only interest is in playing this game. Language matters so much, and to see it being devalued in this way is appalling. I think there's a certain kind of thinking that is language dependent, that is language involving. What we have is a general medium for representing things, language. And that enables us to frame all sorts of thoughts. We can form very specific desires, very specific beliefs that we possible to frame with that. So language is one of the things that enables us to think. And I think people who use it, if they want to help people think through these issues, have a duty to use that instrument very, very carefully. We each of us tuned into real patterns. And this may lead us perhaps to a conflict, because I can see something there as plain as can be. Maybe that's wrong or won't work or that's a bad idea. You, plain as can see something different. And we're just flatly contradicting each other. But maybe you're seeing a different bit of the complex whole. You're picking up one pattern that's really there, and I'm picking up another pattern that's really there. Imagination has a central role in teaching philosophical thinking, because it's only imagination that can get us out of our... Don't write so that you can be understood. Write so that you can't be misunderstood. One thing I love about living in Crete is that the sense of the presence of nature is always here. I walk out the door and I can see the mountains around the city. I can see the white mountains, which for half the year are covered in snow. I can see the sea. If you walk out in the summer, you're immediately aware of your physicality. You become dehydrated very quickly. It's not necessarily a kind environment for humans. It's not if you engage in any vigorous activity, but it's one that makes you feel vividly alive, I think, compared to the area where I grew up, which was a very low-lying area in a river valley. It was a landscape where nature felt almost dormant. The skies would be gray. The landscape would be flat. There was also a lot of human activity in it. Canals, railway lines, coal mines. It was a land that felt as if it had been felt depressed, as if it wasn't allowed to express itself somehow. Now here, it's the opposite. You drive 5 minutes out of the city and you're in a rugged land with almost desert in places, a land where you couldn't survive very long without proper water in particular. And also another thing that you feel here is periods of frequent earthquakes. And that, again, is quite a salutary thing when the earth shakes you like that. And you suddenly realize that this building, which seems wonderfully strong and well-equipped and so on, is suddenly moving from side to side. It makes you see how people could animate this landscape It's a landscape that feels animated with presences, with gods, with non-human entities. There's a way of living which involves engaging more deeply with the meaning of things, not just living life on the surface, but trying to look for the deeper, for the real patterns, and living not without pleasure, not without relishing life, but with relishing it for its complexity. I find I've had difficult times, but I've never been bored. Never, ever been bored. I've always found something to interest me. I've always found life incredibly interesting. And I think if we could have teachers who would inspire children to find life interesting. And by teachers, I don't necessarily mean people employed in schools. I mean people who can inspire young people with a passion for life. I take things very seriously. And I think we need to make them see that a certain kind of seriousness is actually hugely important and hugely rewarding.
We hope you've enjoyed listening to these highlights. To listen to the latest episodes or learn more about participating in exhibitions or interviews, click on subscribe. Thanks for listening.